And this is the case of Stacy versus Meyer. What we will do here today, counsel, first is introduce the members of the court. I'm Mike Havikin, the Chief Justice, and now by order of seniority as to time served on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves.
Good morning. I'm Lindsay Miller-Lerman, appearing by WebEx.
William Castle, good morning.
I'm Stephanie Stacy, good morning.
Good morning, I'm Jeff Funk.
Jonathan Papik, morning.
And John Friedenberg.
And counsel, Mr. Jake Todd, are you here this morning?
I am here.
And Mr. White, are you here this morning?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very good, counsel. Please, while you are at counsel table, keep your masks on. But when you are presenting to the court, please take your mask off so that we can hear and understand what you have to say. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor.
Very good. And now we are here. Mr. Jacot, I have you listed as the appellant. So normally you would argue first. You may approach and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is Travis Jacot, and together with Mr. Patrick Sullivan and Mr. Dooley Jolly of Adams and Sullivan, we represent the appellants Greg Meyer and Mark Meyer in this case. I intend to reserve about 2 minutes for rebuttal time. This case definitely involves emotional facts, and both sides to this case have sympathies that are beyond what most people can comprehend in a lifetime. On one side, you have the children of Molly Stacy, the decedent in this case, and on the other side, you have loved ones of Molly Stacy, Greg Meyer and Mark Meyer. The factual history of this case is Greg Meyer began a romantic relationship with Molly Stacy about 8 years prior to her death. This led to the divorce of both of their respective marriages at the time. But since that time, Greg Meyer and Molly Stacy lived together, and what the facts show should be deemed to be akin to a marriage. Courtney Stacy testified that in 2010, an engagement ring was presented to Miss Stacy, and that Molly Stacy interpreted that ring as a promise that they'd be together forever. And this was a very loving relationship. It's uncontroverted that Greg Meyer took care of Molly during the times in need, and that Greg and Molly both interpreted, or both determined each set of children to be like their own. Now, with those facts, the district court had a difficult job to do. There were over 141 exhibits presented, over 20 witnesses, and the court had to determine whether Molly Stacy lacked capacity and was or had undue influence exerted upon her when she made the asset transfers that she did during her lifetime. But regardless of those emotional facts, not that they're not important, but I think there are four distinct principles of law at stake in this case. And I believe the Nebraska Supreme Court has an important role in reviewing those four issues. Number one is standing. There's a principle of law in Nebraska that only in a state may recover personal and real property assets for a decedent. As the record shows, when this case began following Molly Stacy's death in October of 2017, 2 weeks later, the heirs of the estate, Molly Stacy's children, filed a declaratory judgment action in district court. Part of that action, which is strange in and of itself in this type of instance, filing a declaratory judgment action, part of that action was getting an injunction against Mark Meyer and Greg Meyer. And that injunction was to prevent the transfer of assets throughout the pendency of litigation. Roughly a year later, after defendants had raised the issue of standing that only an estate can challenge those asset transfers, and the special administrator for the estate was appointed in county court without the determination of whether a personal representative should or should not be or cannot be appointed, and then was added to the case as a plaintiff. Now, sealed transcript pages 1 through 22, if the court analyzes that amended complaint, specifically the operative second amended complaint, it will show that the special administrator never specifically joined the claims of undue influence or lack of capacity.
Did you join in the request for relief?
The request for relief, yes, was joined, but the operative pleading of whether there was undue influence or lack of capacity was not joined.
What did he have to do that you contend is missing?
So the process that should have been followed was an estate should have been open from the beginning, and the estate should have been the one challenging the asset transfers. The estate should have been the one alleging undue influence and alleging lack of capacity.
The estate was open at some point. A special administrator was appointed.
Correct, and that was roughly a year.
So I think Justice Papik's question is, what should the special administrator have done to be considered joining in the causes of action?
The special administrator should have taken the case on as its own, pursued the case, alleging undue influence and lack of capacity. As the record shows, the special administrator did nothing to pursue those claims, did not participate in discovery, did not interrogate witnesses, did not call any witnesses.
Signed the complaint, correct?
Correct, yes.
Joined as a request for relief, correct?
Yes, Justice, yeah.
Appeared at trial and said he adopted the arguments that were made by the children, correct?
Yes, Justice, that's correct. And that's another one of the alleged errors, is that a litigant cannot orally adopt claims at trial. There was no request that the judge conform the pleadings to the evidence presented. This was an oral proclamation at the beginning of trial. There's no operative pleading in which the administrator alleges undue influence and mental capacity, and that's critical under Nebraska Probate Code. And not only that, but the probate code has been adopted in every state in the country to some degree. And so this case presents an instance when heirs to an estate are the sole ones challenging undue influence and mental capacity. And from our position, that is a huge factor to whether they have standing.
Counsel, let's assume for the moment that we throw in with the proposition that once the second amended complaint was filed where the special administrator joined, that was proper. What if anything does that do with respect to what occurred prior to that time? What's the jurisdictional status of the proceedings from the moment of inception to the filing of the second amended complaint?
Now, in our view, it wasn't a challenged error, but those pleadings the case should have been dismissed from those pleadings perspective and should have been rebrought by the special administrator.
Were all of the instruments that were challenged in this case subject to the rule of standing you're articulating, that they had to be brought by the special administrator?
No, Justice. The only property that the estate has exclusive jurisdiction over are the real property transfers, so the deeds that were signed on October 20th, and the bank records and all the other documents, all the other property that would have gone to the estate, that should go to the estate in order to probate the estate and distribute to the proper parties. So the insurance beneficiary designations are not included because those are private contractual property that would not go into the estate.
So you're not making an argument that the district court was obligated to dismiss the entire case for lack of standing.
Correct. That's correct.
Your opponent argues that the real party in interest statute contemplates this kind of situation and allows for substitution. Could you respond to that argument?
Yes, that joiner statute specifically is provided in state law to allow parties, say you sue a corporation and it's not the corporation that actually has ownership interest over the subject property. It allows the proper party to be joined in order to fulfill the obligations of the litigation. Now, this case is not applicable under joinder. That could excuse the district court not dismissing it at the time of the first amended complaint to allow the estate to come in. But when the estate did not join in all the operative allegations of the heirs, that is when the standing issue comes in and remained until after trial. So the joiner statute, if the special administrator would have came in and either filed its own operative pleading and the kids could have joined in that if they wanted to, that would not present the same standing issue that we're looking at right now. And again, it's a technical point, and the district court ruled that it would be a miscarriage of justice to not interpret the joiner statute in that way, or to not interpret that the special administrator is a full party of the action. However, that type of approach to the empathetic side of this case ignores the procedural law. If Nebraska, the state of Nebraska wants to allow estate claims to be brought this way, the legislature can certainly do that, but that's not what they've done up until this point. And I'd like to reserve the last minute and a half for rebuttal.
Thank you very much. Mr. White, again, good morning to you, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, members of the court. Thank you for hearing it. It's nice to be back in person. I would like to briefly address the standing issues that you raise. In the inset, at the outset, the Section 25301 of the Nebraska statutes provides that if you've got an don't have a proper party, you have to have a reasonable amount of time to bring them into the lawsuit. Now, the trial court in this case obviously found that whatever the calendar said, it was a reasonable amount of time given what was going on inside of the litigation. So we would submit that rather than a procedural error at the outset that would cause a complete waste of expensive and extensive trial, the trial court made a very practical and fair decision, looked at the pleadings, looked at the substitution of parties, and allowed that. Second, in terms of what I would consider form over substance, the claim that the special administrator had to have his own petition, had to have his own case, had to separately litigate it, invites an incredibly expensive and unnecessarily lengthy trial. Special administrator specifically entered appearance. He showed up daily at that trial. He participated in conferences. He advised the trial court that they fully joined in the argument, and it made sense for the estate.
Mr. White, would you address, I'm asking you essentially the same question I asked your opponent. At the inception of the case, the special administrator was not appointed, was not involved. What's the rationale for allowing that case to begin and to proceed to initiate claims that clearly belonged to an estate?
Well, I can say, Your Honor, is there a legal basis for that to be done initially? No. The question is whether it was corrected. And we would submit to the court that it was corrected. But I would also point out, Justice Pappas made a very good point.
I guess I'm also concerned about the future implications of this type of procedure. If we put our blessing on this, aren't we in essence encouraging heirs to disregard the requirement that these claims be pursued by a personal representative or special administrator and just jump into court on their own? And conceivably you could have conflicting groups of heirs that don't agree on what the process is. And rather than having a system that makes sense, you would have chaos, wouldn't you?
Well, I would submit to Your Honor the system self-corrected. That in fact, exactly the point that you make, that the special administrator needed to bring these claims, that issue was raised in the trial court, and then pursuant to 25301, it was self-corrected. The reason that I would submit to you that it was not inappropriate for the case to proceed is Justice Papik made a good point. Over $500,000 that was transferred came out of insurance proceeds that was a valid claim for both the children, AJ and Courtney, to pursue. So that case was going to go forward. The question really is, Judge, do you have to get it 100% right the first time? I mean, we call it the practice of law because we make mistakes. And the legislature and the procedures say, yeah, we see you may have made a mistake. You didn't join the right party initially, but it was raised, the right ruling was made, and then it was corrected. And I think that is really does not invite chaos. That is just the opposite. It recognizes that we make technical decisions at fast, and you can't be 100% right away. That will be chaotic. What instead is make sure you get it right, make sure it's corrected, and make sure the right result occurred. And I would submit to the court that's exactly what happened. The trial court made the right ruling, made the correction on the fly as it needed to. And there's no question that the administrator was the party in charge on the issue of the real property. I would like the court, I know that the procedural issue is very much on the court's mind, but I'd like to point out the actual underlying facts of this are pretty egregious. The Greg Meyer, the appellant here, wouldn't testify at trial. Overwhelming evidence of absolute overbearing control on a woman who has had 7 different medications or biological conditions that at any moment could cause delirium, and he controlled the medications for all 7. He excluded her children, lied to her son about her condition so that her son never saw her alive, that he came too late, that the daughter who was in Kansas City, he hid it from her, and by the time she got to her mother's bedside, her mother was unconscious. So the question then is, why? Why did that occur? Well, the answer is, if you look at the chronology, she died. Molly died on the 23rd of October. On the 20th, $500,000 or more was transferred. And the houses, well, no, I'm sorry, the houses were transferred both in Florida and Bellevue. That's probably $1 million worth of real estate or better. There was a conscious plan and effort to strip away the children's inheritance. Now, should that control the procedures and whatever errors were made at the outset, Your Honor? No. But should it also be taken into account that in the end, our duty is to do justice, to try to right wrongs, and that procedures there to help us do justice? And in this case, whatever errors were made initially, I would submit to the court were corrected properly pursuant to the statutes. I would be happy to address any questions any other member of the court might have on the facts or if there are other procedural concerns.
We have a number of transactions that are challenged. You have some deeds, yes. Life insurance, retirement.
Yes.
And as I understood the party's briefing, it seemed to be that our standard of review for all of those transactions would be the same.
We believe that it is an equity claim, and the burden of proof we accepted was clear and convincing evidence. And then this court's de novo on the record, giving credence to the fact that the trial court saw the witnesses and could evaluate them and their credibility. One of the things that was raised by the appellant that I think is not a fair reading of the trial court's opinion is that somehow the trial court did a greater weight of the evidence rather than clear and convincing. And that's not a fair reading of what the court wrote. It simply was commenting not on the burden of proof, but was commenting on the credibility of the various witnesses when they made the comment attributed to them. So I do think that in cases of capacity, it's clear and convincing. I'm not sure it's as clear, Your Honor, with regard to undue influence, but we accepted the higher burden in either event because we believe the evidence demonstrates it very strongly.
I'd also like to ask you one question about your cross appeal.
Yes.
You owed. As I read the resulting trust cases, they seem to refer to 2 different presumptions. A, there may be a presumption that a resulting trust arises because one party supplied the purchase money for the property at issue. On the other hand, there might be an opposite presumption if the people between whom the property is exchanged have a close relationship. Could you address those 2 arguably competing presumptions and how they fit into your cross appeal?
Well, I often find the law to be a confusing thing, Your Honor. What I would submit is the purchase money trust, and clear that the money came from Molly Stacy. And then the boat was licensed in Mark's name. Now, there were different reasons claimed for that at different times, and the testimony was very scrambled. And I would say, given that scrambled testimony, Your Honor, the presumption of a close ties doesn't really apply in this situation. It was licensed in Mark's name at one point because they claim it was a gift, but another time because he was licensed to operate the boat in Florida and Molly was not, which would indicate it wasn't a gift. And at the same time, one of the times his father, Greg Meyer, took the Fifth Amendment in his deposition was because he had listed himself as the owner of the boat on insurance forms, which of course would be a crime in Nebraska to falsely claim ownership and insurable interest in property you don't own. So given that tangled web, I would submit to you in this situation under these facts, the purchase money trust should predominate rather than the other line of cases. The one last point I'd like to make with the court permission is, again, Mr. Meyer didn't come forward and testify. And that's particularly important because if we've met the initial burden of, may I finish that statement?
You may.
Thank you, Your Honor. If we've met that initial burden of evidence of control, improper influence, then it was incumbent on the appellant to come forward and to present evidence, not shifting the burden, but the duty to come forward with evidence that such control did not exist. And no such testimony was offered, nor could it be credibly. Thank you for your attention and courtesy today.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
1 minute and 29 seconds,
Mr. Jacob.
Thank you again, Mr. Chief Justice. As far as the Greg Meyer not testifying, I would submit that there are over 600 pages of testimony brought to the court. The plaintiff never called Greg Meyer to testify. The plaintiff decided to read from the deposition to provide Mr. Greg Meyer's testimony. So the point that the defendant didn't call him, that doesn't mean there was no evidence rebutting undue influence. There's plenty of evidence rebutting undue influence. And that's when I want to get into the appellee's point about justice in this case. What is justice is affirming what Molly Stacey wanted. Molly Stacey made these decisions. It's unrefuted that these things happened. The question is whether lack of mental capacity existed, which the appellee's own expert testified that there was no clear medical evidence prior to October 20th that there was lack of mental capacity.
What do you contend we should do, if anything, about the trial court statement that you found the plaintiff's witnesses more credible than those called?
Yes, Justice, and that's important. And this court should give great deference to the credibility and the weight analysis by the district court. However, we would submit that the evidence that the court placed credibility on for the appellee side does not provide the full facts necessary to prove undue influence and lack of capacity. Their witnesses testified that she never wanted to get married again, that she was really sick, and that all those things are uncontroverted. And Appellant accepts that. What the only independent witnesses in this case testified to, namely Mr. Von der Lagging, Mr. Drews, and Mr. Hike, is that she did have capacity and she wasn't unduly influenced. And if I could just make one more brief point, Your Honor.
You may.
Thank you. There were three medical experts in this case called. Appellant chose one, Mr. Davis. Appellee chose one, Mr. Kremen. But the only one Molly Stacey chose was Dr. Hike. And Dr. Hike testified that she had capacity and she was not unduly influenced. And with that, appellant's request that this court reverse the district court's order. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Counsel, that concludes arguments in Stacey versus Meyer. Please continue to wear your masks and socially distance as you leave the courtroom, and please leave by the side door to the court's left to your right.
Are you excused, Your Honor?
Yes, you are.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.